helping students and healthcare professionals not just survive, but thrive with a purpose. This is the CMDA Student Pulse Podcast with your host, Bill Reichart, National Director of CMDA Campus Ministries.
Well, welcome to another episode of CMDA Student Pulse Podcast. I'm Bill Reichert, our National Director for Campus and Community Ministries here at CMDA. And my guest in studio is Dr. Scott Armistead. Welcome, Scott.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Yeah. Well, we've been together for a couple of days this week at our National Field Staff Conference here at headquarters. That's what gives us an opportunity to have this conversation in the studio. And just before the conference, there was a fairly extensive article in World Magazine and World Magazine podcast on some things that you've been journeying through these last couple of years. Mm. And I thought maybe this would be a great opportunity to unpack that a little bit, and especially for our listeners, most of whom are students or residents, to maybe be encouraged and can be helped by hearing your own story as it relates to your right of conscience. And so a little bit about yourself currently is that you're a family physician in Richmond, Virginia, correct?
That's correct.
Area director with our CMDA ministry there in Richmond as well, mm-hmm. and working with InMed and medical missions. And you were a doctor in a missionary hospital for, 17 years?
16 years.
16 years.
Right, South Asia.
Yeah, fantastic. And I should also, I don't want to fail to mention, married three boys, too.
That's correct, all of whom are married now.
All right. Yeah. So they're off the payroll, huh?
Yes, that's right.
Good. Okay, so you settled in Richmond. You've been practicing medicine. But you came back from overseas, and just tell a little bit the background of, what gets us to the place where there's, some of the things that have been more in the public sphere. You were at VCU, and you were working. You were working with students as well, too.
That's right, yeah. When we came back from overseas about 10 years ago, I started working part-time mm-hmm. in a clinic predominantly for underserved folks that was associated with the family medicine department at VCU.
Okay. And you've been away from American medicine for about 16 years. You come back, you notice some differences or some changes, or it's not quite the same kind of medicine that you remember leaving 16 years ago. What were some of the changes you quickly observed as you started to practice in VCU?
Yeah, so it took a while to move from one very yeah. different milieu in South Asia to one back in America. But I did notice over time, that the culture had shifted in those 16 years. We left mm-hmm. in 1999. We returned in 2015. And okay. we did some furloughs mm-hmm. between that time. But I wasn't living in America, and I wasn't mm-hmm. engaged in America. But one thing I noticed that was a subtle shift that became more clear over time is that the language of professional wasn't used so much. Mm-hmm. I don't even remember using the word provider in 1999 when I was working in the United States before we left for South Asia. But that had become the sort of common language.
Yeah.
And then I tried to figure out, well, what does that actually mean? What cultural reality yeah. does that reflect? And I did a lot of time, spent a lot of time sort of processing that and reading about it and trying yeah. to figure out, because I knew that there had been cultural shifts, yeah. but it was hard to lay my finger on them. But that was one of them.
Well, I'd like to even just touch on that provider professional descriptor. I mean, what is the difference? How is that important, that switch? Or what meaning does that carry with it that we've moved from professional to provider?
Yeah, so a professional is someone who has something to profess. Mm-hmm. And I think that for a follower of Jesus, mm-hmm. working in healthcare, we can profess the many things. We yeah. can profess the dignity of every single patient, but we also mm-hmm. can profess the objective reality of health. Mm-hmm. And with the spread of postmodern thought, I think that many things in the U.S. had sort of shifted to mm-hmm. from objective to subjective, and even that had influenced the healthcare profession so that one's health even became a subjective mm-hmm. matter. Yeah, which is it's very incongruous in a sense, mm-hmm. with the way that we're trained. But I think that that's one of the problems that I encountered. So an objective view of health, an understanding clearly of what we're doing in medicine.
Yeah.
I think I couldn't have worded it when I was in medical school, but just having looked into it in more detail, I came to see the goal or the telos or the end or the purpose of medicine to be the maintenance of the excellence of the body and the restoration of the body to its natural excellence. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, is reflective of a Christian understanding of the goodness of creation, the goodness of matter, but intended by God from the very beginning.
Mm.
But in the provider model,
yeah.
Then one becomes simply a vending machine, right. sort of doing whatever the patient wants, whatever is legal, whatever the societies might say is acceptable standard of care.
Right. It becomes almost just transactional. It's a different model, different paradigm.
Yes.
So you're sensing some change. You know, you're saying, okay, this is we're not in Kansas anymore. This is a uniquely right. different place than when I left 16 years ago. But then you encountered there were some changes in the intake and some of the ways that you would be addressing patients. Describe a little bit how that came about.
Yeah, it started out, I think it was 2019, with the introduction of an intake form,
yeah.
you know, the general form that everybody fills out before right. they see their primary care doctor. And, you know, among the things that were standard was past medical, surgical, family, social history, all those kind of things. But then there were gender assigned at birth, present gender with a list of many options, including other. Mm-hmm. And then there were really detailed check boxes of sexual activity. You know, a male who has sex with men, with transgender men, with women, with transgender women, anal, mm-hmm. oral, vaginal, with or without a condom. Mm-hmm. And this was on a general intake form.
Everybody got it.
They got it, in fact, before they even came to the mm-hmm. office. They got it in the mail, sitting on the counter in the kitchen or whatever. And many of my patients were immigrants, and many of my patients mm-hmm. were Muslim, because I can write my name in Arabic mm-hmm. and I can speak a South Asian language, which is mm-hmm. common for Muslims. So I think they were attracted to me, and I to them.
Yeah.
I mean, I really loved caring for them, mm-hmm. and I sort of knew the cultural cues mm-hmm. when I walked in the room with a new patient and I spoke their language, and they were so delighted with that. But I knew that in cultures that are characterized by, you know, head coverings and mm-hmm. burqas and hijabs and just that kind of casualness or sort of lack of reticence or just lack of carefulness in dealing with the very sort of sensitive aspects of life, such as sexual behavior, that would not go over well with these cultural populations. Yes. And we had patients from Yemen and Syria and Afghanistan and Pakistan and mm-hmm. North Africa. And even my mother, my nurse said, yeah. I wouldn't want my mama to see that form.
Oh, gosh. She's yeah. embarrassed, yeah.
Yeah, so I push back against that form,
yes.
mainly from the perspective of cultural competence.
Right.
And I made the suggestion that maybe we should ask someone from these different cultures whom we were serving what they thought of the form. You know, I realize that these kind of questions are ones that we need to ask
yes.
at times in patient encounters. It's just mm-hmm. the way it is. We need to know the details. But that's, you know, in my training, and certainly in South Asia, that would be the kind of thing that would only be done within the privacy of the physician-patient.
Stay with us. More Student Pulse podcast in just a moment.
We'll be right back.
be so trivialized as it appeared to be so in those intake forms. So you shared that concern, and I thought it's actually a question to ask more questions and to hopefully learn more from the patients as to what would be appropriate. But how was that, how was your concern as it was expressed received?
I got an email back that said received.
So that's how it was received.
That's how it was received.
It was
that
received.
Was the extent of the reception, and there was no dialogue about it. Yeah, and I continued to ask, and then I found out that it was going to be implemented. It had gone through the lawyers, and I guess that's how things go in big medical universities, and it was implemented, and I refused to use it. I graciously did so, and they made an exception for me.
They did.
And said that my patients didn't need to receive that form, but in two cases it came through, and one was a gay man. Mm. And the form never even made it to me because he told my nurse they shouldn't be asking about my private life like that. And she said, "Oh, don't worry, Dr. Armstead doesn't like that form anyway," and she threw it away, and we never discussed it. And then in the other case, it was an Indian woman, and I could speak her language, and she said, "This culture is very odd."
Indeed.
Yeah.
Okay, but it doesn't just stop there. It begins to even ratchet up further with the issue of pronouns, preferred pronouns, and how you might address the patient too. When did that begin? What was the genesis?
Yeah, well, so this we found out that a new policy had been implemented in the training of the students. Mm-hmm. So as they were learning to interview standardized patients, mm-hmm. you know, those who are paid by the school to act as patients, they were told that they needed to identify themselves with their own preferred pronouns and then mm-hmm. ask the standardized patients what their preferred pronouns would be mm-hmm. with the intention that as they came to see my patients, because I was working with second year medical students, in fact a lot of second year medical students, we even had a special program because I was so eager to teach because I love teaching and I had done a lot of that in South Asia my latter years. So the intention was that would be the way that they would interview my patients at my clinic mm-hmm. when I served as their preceptor. So when I and a colleague found out about this, we thought, first of all, why didn't they ask us if this would be an appropriate way for the medical students to introduce themselves to our patients? But then we also thought it was culturally incompetent mm-hmm. to do so, and then it might confuse or even offend some of the patients, you know, asking a woman from Syria, you know, does she identify as a woman or what pronouns? It would be a really odd question to ask. So I pushed back at the level of the medical school against the department that oversaw their patient interview procedures mm-hmm. and question the wisdom of that.
Yeah. Oh, that I'm sure the students appreciated your advocacy on their behalf, and but that meant that you also put a bullseye on your back, and it put you in the line of fire, did it not?
Well, at first it seemed to be well received.
Okay.
It was during COVID, and when we had a meeting over Zoom with some of the folks from that committee, and mm-hmm. they listened, and it seemed as though they would perhaps reconsider. And they did make the comment that as students went out to their particular clinics, because, you know, students came to my clinic, but they went to clinics all over the city, mm-hmm. That they could talk with their preceptor individually about the appropriateness of this type of interviewing mm-hmm. method. Yeah. So, but then also students came to me independent of my own initiating of questions about the new policy, because they felt uncomfortable with it. They felt as though it was forcing a type of speech on them. So we were sort of doing this I was doing it on my own with a colleague, but also students were approaching me saying that they were uncomfortable with it. And then it led to really talking about why they were uncomfortable with it. You know, what type of anthropology does this sort of pronouns language reflect? And is that coherent, and is it consistent with a holistic, you know, integrated, embodied anthropology that was the type of anthropology that was assumed when I was in medical school,
right.
and one that I sort of believed in. I believed it to be a good way of yeah. seeing the patient. Hmm.
Well, it sounds like you were in dialogue, but there was a point when the relationship deteriorated. What led to that part of the story? Because your relationship with the institution was eventually severed, correct?
Yes, that's correct. Well, there were two things that happened before the relationship with the institution was severed. The medical school students told me that they found out that they were going to be graded on this matter.
Oh.
And that brought them more into the forefront okay. of the issue. And they themselves, seven students, put together a letter that went to that same committee that I had met with mm-hmm. saying, you know, one, our faculty don't do this. Mm-hmm. We've never seen them do this. Two, it reflects an understanding, an anthropological understanding that we don't agree with,
right.
and we're being forced to sort of speak out of an understanding that is not our own of what it means to be a patient or what it means to be a human being. And they asked for dialogue with that school mm-hmm. committee. And unfortunately, I was really disappointed in this. Mm-hmm. What happened was a letter went out to all of the first and second year medical students, not mentioning these students' specific names, but okay. but saying that there had been pushback against the new policy and that they needed to just learn to accept it because there was opposition to the first time that they wanted to integrate African American patients into the clinic. So they likened it to that experience, and I don't think that they really took seriously the student's conscience,
mm-hmm.
you know, being forced to speak a certain way, and I don't think that they took seriously the student's sort of philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
yeah, and they didn't take the offer for dialogue, which has been one of the most sad things to me.
Yeah,
how little dialogue there has been at the medical school. But my personal story is the next batch of students, of eight students that I had, mm-hmm. At the very beginning of the time, I said, I know you're being taught this way in terms of doing patient interviews, but I really don't think it would make sense in this cultural context because I'm worried about my patients. If you introduce yourself that way, they might be confused or offended. And then I said also that I question the dualistic, I don't think I said it that way, but basically separating the person and the body.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think that that was a healthy way to see patients, and I didn't think it was healthy for our profession or for our civilization. So I sort of questioned the reigning anthropological ideology, and that's what got me in trouble.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, it got you in trouble. It didn't renew your contract, I believe, right? And then...
Well, it was a process.
It was a process.
So first of all, I think there was a student who complained about that because that student felt threatened. I never really heard the specifics, but a couple months later, I was called into a meeting and I was accused of harassment and discrimination.
Oh, boy.
And I was also told, it was said that I had said that people with gender dysphoria were, quote, broken, and I had never said that.
Mm.
So I think there were false accusations against me. And then I was given, as a consequence of that, in this letter of reprimand, I was given a period of 6 months in which I was forbidden from working with students. I could still see patients, but I couldn't have any students with me. And that was an awkward time because I knew I was being watched, and my nurse came to me one day and she said, "Dr. Armstead, they're watching you like a hawk. You better watch every move you make."
Oh.
So, I'd heard from friends if a place wants to get rid of you, they would look for
things
like clinical near misses because they couldn't really do it based on just this ideological thing. But at the end of that time, I was called in to another meeting and sure enough, it was this listing of clinical near misses, and I asked for a listing of those, and they really were all of no consequence. And then also relational problems. And then I was lost. My contract was not renewed.
Right. Well, that's the first part of this, because the second part is that you you sought after some recourse, and I'd like to hear what led to your decision. You could have taken this in a lot of different directions, but you chose to legally pursue some remedies.
Yeah, I did for a while, and you know, it actually for a long while. Mm-hmm. So I sort of gathered all the information together and mm-hmm. all the documentation and presented it to a particular group in Richmond. Mm-hmm. And in the providence of God, my life was busy. You know, yeah. So I was working in a new job and still doing a ministry with CMDA,
yes,
and
still
taking students to Africa, mm-hmm. and Asia, and
it's a full life.
Yeah, and I didn't meet a particular deadline because things have to be reported in a certain amount of time.
Oh.
And in the providence of God, the case was dropped.
Oh, okay.
And I'm actually glad of that because I don't really see myself as a culture warrior.
Mm.
I mean, we all have to address issues of culture mm-hmm. and issues of conscience, and I suppose some might say I am a culture warrior, but I'm not a vitriolic kind of person.
No.
I don't really like fights, and and I wanted a relationship. I still do,
yeah,
with the medical school, and I've been able to maintain that relationship with the medical school, not
okay.
so much in the department itself,
right,
but because I take medical students to the refugee clinic, and I take them to the charity mm-hmm. clinic in Richmond, and I take them to the mission hospital mm-hmm. in Zimbabwe for fourth year electives, and I'm interested in bioethics, and
mm-hmm.
so I've been invited in multiple contexts to maintain a relationship, to be involved in the students' lives, and I'm grateful for that. And maybe that would have been different had I had a case against them.
Stay with us. More Student Pulse podcast in just a moment.
Hi, I'm Dr. Bill Griffin, here to tell you about a tremendous resource for Christian healthcare professionals called the Saline Process. This training seminar will give you the capacity and the confidence to address the spiritual needs of your patients within the context of the care you currently provide each day. To learn more and to perhaps host an event in your area, just go to cmda.org/saline. May the Lord use this powerful program to equip you for truly holistic patient care.
Well, it has gone into the public discourse because World Magazine and the podcast, and there's been some press about this and kind of talked openly about your story. What kind of responses have you gotten to some of that?
Yeah, I think that a lot of folks, particularly of my generation or older,
mm-hmm.
are really not aware of the kind of challenges that medical students are facing now.
Mm-hmm.
I was, as a result of this all happening, I decided to go to the Medical Society of Virginia,
okay.
and I presented a proposal about conscience protections, basically mm-hmm. looking at the AMA position, which is quite robust, done mm-hmm. some years ago, and we basically took the AMA statement on conscience protection for physicians and said we need to affirm this in the state of Virginia. So I presented that to the Medical Society
yeah.
of Virginia as a active member
yeah.
of the Medical Society, and it was approved. Okay. But it was very interesting to me. I was telling the medical students about that upcoming meeting, you know, 3 or 4 weeks before
yeah.
it happened, and the medical students said immediately, I want to go and support that. And the reason that they did that is because in the previous week in their ethics class,
mm-hmm.
they had been told that if the patient wants it, if the society say it's acceptable standard of care
mm-hmm.
of medicine, then you really should ignore what you think about things and just do it. And the
wow.
students were very upset about that.
Mm-hmm.
They thought, how can I practice medicine
yeah.
that way? How can I practice ignoring my conscience?
Your vending machine, again, the provider
the
model.
Provider service model, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I quickly had students say, I want to come with you.
Oh, wow.
I want to testify on the on the importance of this proposal. Mm. And we did that both at the Medical Society of Virginia, and then later we presented that at the state legislature. It was not passed in a subcommittee, but mm-hmm. we know that sometimes these things take multiple trials over mm-hmm. time.
Yours is certainly not the only story that's out there. There's been some news about other gentlemen whose journey has taken many years and is, I think, finally resolved in the courts. And where do you think medicine is going? I mean, what are these? Are these one-offs that we're seeing, like what you experienced, or is there a systemic transformation of medicine as you now see it?
Yeah, I think that Farr Curlin is quite right. You know, he's been a speaker at CMDA and wrote the book The Way of Medicine, where he does a really wonderful job. He and another author do a wonderful job of contrasting what they call the way of medicine versus the provider service model. And I think that discussion, that argument, those two opposing ways of seeing what we are doing in medicine really need to be addressed. And Leon Cass, who was an earlier bioethicist, part of the Presidential Commission some decades ago, he basically said, if we don't know what is our goal, what is our telos, what is our purpose, what are we actually doing here, then we're not going to reach it. And so he wrote a very wonderful article called The End of Medicine. So basically he was saying the end or the goal, if the end is not clear, then medicine as we know it really could end up in a lot of confusion. Wow. Yeah. And I'm also quite concerned. I know that Stanley Hauerwas, also an ethicist from Duke, if I remember correctly, he's concerned that people like me, who follow sort of a traditional whole person, integrated, deeply respecting the embodied human being, if society shifts more and more away from that model, it really could be difficult to practice in institutions that had such a different model. So, I mean, thanks be to God, one out of six beds in the United States are Catholic beds, then I think that people would find themselves more at home in those type of institutions, unless there really is a change in medicine where we figure out, what are we doing here? What is our goal? How do we view what it means to be an embodied human being?
Yeah, that's good. Good word. Kind of looking back in hindsight, looking in your rearview mirror, Scott, what has this journey taught you? What are any big lessons you pulled out? And maybe, you know, related to that is your relationship with God. How was that impacted through this process, through this journey?
Yeah, I think it's no coincidence in the providence of God that my wife and I have been on this sort of exploration of joy, relational joy. At that happened maybe a year before all of this turmoil happened in my life, where we were taking a sort of deep dive into thinking about joy. Joy as a result of someone else saying, I delight in you, you delight in me. It's a beautiful model of the gospel, saying even though we don't really have anything to offer God except for our broken selves, that God looks on us in love as a father would or mother would a small child, having nothing to offer but dirty diapers, and just delights in us, and we light up in response. Very simple concept, but a very enriching one. And I remember the day that I went in for the meeting where I felt like, oh, I'm about to get slammed. I stood at the doorway just looking into the eyes of my wife, and with her smiling eyes telling me who I am, telling me that I'm a beloved husband, and similarly God telling me that I'm a beloved adopted child of his because of what Christ has done. You know, it that is the strength that I needed for that season in my life, and I'm very, very grateful for it.
Wow. Lastly, as we wrap up our conversation, I usually like to have our guests, if they can, if it's appropriate, to kind of talk directly to the students, assuming, again, most of our audience are students and residents. And you work with students so often, so I imagine you've had these conversations over coffee, but they're facing this, you know, and there's a power differential. They're students, and they're having to keep their head down. They want to get to school. There's a lot of, you know, they want to stay out of trouble. But then these issues are coming up, as they did at VCU with these students. How would you encourage students to stand strong and to persevere and to, you know, press through these challenges which they're likely to face?
Yes. Yeah, I talk to students quite a lot about identity. Henry Nouwen's book, The Way of the Heart, I love that book because he says we can't be defined by what we do, which in medicine is very much a temptation, by what other people think about us, which happens all the time in medical school because you're being evaluated, or by what we own, by what we have. Which medical students, residents don't have that much, but they are about to have more because they are high income earners.
Yes.
But we have to detach ourselves, in a sense, from those things so that we can be reattached, fully attached to Jesus, who can tell us who we really are. So I think the inward journey is easily neglected in American culture because of distraction upon distraction. And in medicine, because we're so consumed with busyness. But the Nouwen says that the harder the external journey, the deeper the internal journey needs to be. So my first advice would be to not neglect the internal journey. Develop habits of heart so that you are told by God each day who you really are. Otherwise, you'll believe the lies about what our culture and your institution tells you who you are. Because as the challenges come, you need a solid basis. You need joy in order to be able to handle those challenges, because they're complex, and there is the power differential, and there's the fear factor, and there's the fatigue factor, because it this whole thing took a lot of emotional energy. But then the other thing would be to band together. You know, It's very important that you be a part of a community of people who are on the same journey to identification and deep identity in Christ. Even if those are only one other classmate or two other classmates, it's very important to meet together, to pray together, to talk about these issues, so that we don't feel alone. I learned that from working in South Asia, where I was part of a tiny religious minority, a persecuted minority, and the togetherness and the camaraderie and the belonging to one another that happened in that context was just a very, very precious thing to me. And I realized how important it is for them and how important it is for us as a minority in the medical education systems to survive and thrive and to develop the skills and the posture for being a blessing in our future careers.
Yeah, well, that's a good word. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Scott Armistead, for being faithful to the Lord and relying and resting and clinging tightly to the gospel, to know that you are a beloved son of the King, and resting in that and taking a stand for righteousness Yes, I appreciate you so much, and I could go on and on, because I could tell you students that you know, and they've maybe said this to you, but how much of a deep impact you've made in their lives. The investments you're making in the next generation are not going unnoticed, and I just want to thank you so much for your faithful service to them and to the Lord.
Amen. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for watching. We'll see you next time. CMDA's Student Pulse podcast is a production of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. The opinions expressed by guests on this podcast are not necessarily endorsed by the organization. CMDA is non-partisan and does not endorse political parties or candidates for public office. The views expressed on Student Pulse podcast reflect judgments regarding principles and values held by CMDA and its members.